For years, I've been bragging on the team at Allied Outdoor Solutions in Houston for the beautiful work they do to make your outdoor area, your backyard, look like a resort. Well, their business has just grown and grown organically because they do great work. Your walkways, the area around your pool, your outdoor kitchen, all of that. AlliedOutdoorSolutions.com. And now, over the years, it's taken 20 years, they're now in Austin, Dallas, and San Antonio. AlliedOutdoorSolutions.com. 844-846-1010. Call them at 844-846-1010.
It's that time. Lock and load. The Michael Vary Show is on the air.
Friday evening, as we signed off, news came across the ticker. Longtime Supreme Court Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had died at the age of 87. So the entire weekend, the number one story in America has been the replacement process, including the timeline. And of course, a lot of developments. And there's no one I'd rather talk to at this moment than our own friend, Professor Josh Blackman of the South Texas College of Law. I have a number of questions for him, and he's going to be our guest here for a little while as we go through the ins and outs of this. I'm actually going to work backwards because I want to go through her career and all that, but let's get to the questions that people want to know. And on everything that I'm going to ask, I think there is a what should he do or what can he do and what will he do with regard to the president nominating a replacement? And that's our first question. The president is saying that he will nominate a replacement. It could be as early as today. It could be later this week. What do you think he'll do?
Well, thank you for having me, Michael. I think President Trump will make a nomination as soon as possible. It could be today, it could be tomorrow, but it's going to be really soon. The reason why is the nomination starts the clock on the confirmation process. This process doesn't happen overnight. There's steps. You first make the nomination, then you have a hearing before a committee of about 20 senators. They vote up or down, and then it goes to the full floor of the full Senate for a vote. In theory, you can do the entire thing in less than 40 days. You'd have to move really quickly. So in theory, if Trump and McConnell wanted to, you could get a floor vote before the election. You could even get a floor vote the day before the election, or hell, on election day. But the timing matters. Yeah, I thought about that option. Make the floor vote the day before the election. Really make it count. And at that point, we're in this sort of marathon. Another option is Trump makes a nomination. They hold a hearing before the election, and then they vote after the election, which creates some really funky scenarios where if Trump loses and they still put in the justice, I think we're looking at Armageddon.
Well, but let's go back to the words of Ruth Bader Ginsburg in 2016, when Antonin Scalia dies suddenly, the greatest justice in my mind of my lifetime. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg makes the statement that the senators need to do their jobs. A president is president for 4 years, not just three. He is still the president. He still does have that power. This sense of courtesy or whatever else might be something that Democrats want. But, I mean, from a purely constitutional perspective, it's the president's nomination to make and the Senate's job to vote it up or down, right?
Look, I think I was on your program in 2016 with the exact same issue. So here's what the Constitution says. The president shall make a nomination. Okay, that's his job. Mm-hmm. Obama nominated Merrick Garland, who's a good man, and now Trump's going to nominate someone else, probably a good woman, if I had to guess. At that point, it's up to the Senate what to do. There's no obligation to do anything. In 2016, Senate Majority Leader McConnell said, we're not going to take a move, we're not going to do anything, and that was it. Now McConnell says, we're going to move as fast as we can. You can call it hypocritical, you can call it whatever you want, but the Constitution's silent on these issues. He's president, he can make his nomination, and if there are a majority of senators to vote for, then we have a new justice. And then in a few months, the Democrats retaliate as they see fit.
But it strikes me that this is why you vote. This is why you campaign. This is why you contribute to candidates, because elections matter. If Democrats had had control of the Senate in 2016 instead of Republicans, then Obama would have been able to cram down, you know, Merrick Garland as their nominee and become a justice. And in this case, the president won the presidency and Republicans won the Senate majority. And this is why this matters. And so you make it happen. I mean, I guess we're getting into political questions instead of legal questions. Then let me ask you a personality question. Is Amy Coney Barrett, the president did say over the weekend that he will make a nomination, it will be quick, and it will be a woman. Is she the woman?
Yeah. I'll tell you, Michael, I feel more confident about Judge Barrett than I felt about Judge Kavanaugh. And I know I was on your program a couple of times. I was never a huge rah-rah Kavanaugh cheerleader.
Me neither.
I don't know that I'm an Amy Coney Barrett cheerleader, but I feel better about her than I do about him. And I'll give you some anecdotes that may put you at ease. She was a law professor for many years, so I knew her before she was famous, as the saying goes. And I thought she was always very careful. She clerked for Justice Scalia on the Supreme Court. Scalia doesn't pick weak people; he picks strong people. When Judge Barrett was nominated to the appellate court, she was attacked by Dianne Feinstein, a senator from California. And Senator Feinstein made this remark where she said, "The dogma lives loudly in you." Judge Barrett's a devout Catholic, very devout. She teaches at Notre Dame. That says something. And she was attacked for her faith. And there was a huge blowback. And Judge Barrett held herself strong. And she didn't fight. She didn't back down. She fought against Judge Feinstein. I think for this nomination, you need someone who's a fighter and who will not back down and will be willing to assert herself against the coming onslaught, because this person will be destroyed. Her family will be destroyed. Her character will be assassinated. Nothing matters except for stopping her from getting onto the court. Even if she never gets a vote, she'll still be destroyed. So what makes me confident about Judge Barrett is she'll survive the process. Once she gets in the court, who the heck knows? Kavanaugh surprised me. Gorsuch surprised me. They're not, you know, Republican judges are not robots that do what you think they're going to do. They do their own thing. So I can't assure anyone of this anymore, but I think she does have the strength to make it through this gauntlet she has to run.
One of the issues that comes up in the opposition to her nomination, of course, is that she is very pro-life. And against abortion. Is that the issue that you expect the biggest criticism of her on?
Sure. I'm sure she's pro-life in her private beliefs. I don't know that she's had much of an occasion as a judge to write about abortion. I think there's a difference between what you believe in your faith and what you believe the Constitution says. Although, you know, Michael, for most people, there's no difference. If you're pro-life, you're against Roe v. Wade. And if you're pro-choice, you like Roe v. Wade. They're one and the same. Republicans have a fairly small majority in the Senate. There are a couple women senators, Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski in Alaska, who value abortion laws. And they value Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. And it might be hard for them to vote for Judge Brad Barrett, given her path. There's a very narrow path here. McConnell, I'm sure, will try to thread the needle, but it's a very narrow path to majority.
Well, the narrow path with Susan Collins and Murkowski already coming out and saying that they will not vote, coming out this weekend and saying they will not vote to fill the replacement. If they stick to their guns on that, that makes this best case a 50-50 vote, and Pence has to come in and break the tie. So this gets very, very interesting very, very quickly, doesn't it?
Don't forget Mitt Romney.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, I guess you're 53-47, and I was reading that it goes 50-50, and then you've got the – if you hold everybody else – and who knows if you hold everybody else. I mean, Rand has been known at a time like this to kind of renegotiate some things. We're talking to Professor Josh Blackman. Who better to talk to at a time like this of the South Texas College of Law and the expert on the Supreme Court? And we'll continue that conversation coming up.
This segment exclusively produced by Hawaiian Chad Nakanishi. Aloha, broha, the Michael Berry Show.
Mm-hmm. are talking to Professor Josh Blackman of the South Texas College of Law with Ruth Bader Ginsburg's unexpected passing Friday night. We're talking about the process of her replacement. And will that nomination be made by Donald Trump and voted on by this Senate led by Mitch McConnell? Or will it be made by the next president, which may well be Donald Trump, and they can't put this off for another 4 years? But if it's Joe Biden, of course, with a lifetime appointment, the Democrats would like to stall this thing and make that nomination, and then hopefully for them have a Senate majority to approve it. But you know what? One of, as you game this thing out, Professor, one of the situations that comes up is Biden wins the presidency, but Republicans hold on to the Senate, which could very well happen. And now you have him trying to get Biden trying to get a nominee through a Republican-controlled Senate, which you'd have to think would make your nominee, if nothing else, your nominee would have to be a bit more moderate, right? Less of a lefty.
Well, Michael, you're assuming that Trump doesn't fill the nominee before January.
Sure.
I don't know that's true, but let's just say that the seat's empty come January and the GOP has a Senate majority. I think the seat remains empty for 2 years. I don't think the Republicans will play ball, because they know full well as soon as the Democrats get the majority, they'll just expand the court further. I mean, this is a cudgel. I don't want to make this point too blunt, but we're looking at a radical change in our government coming up. And I think there's four distinct things the Democrats can and will do. The first is they'll eliminate the filibuster, which means they could pass any legislation they want, the Green New Deal, the tax and cap, whatever legislation you can dream of, it will be passed. The second change they'll make is they will grant statehood to D.C. and perhaps Puerto Rico. That would immediately give the Democrats four more Senate votes and more votes in the House, and it would boost the Electoral College. It would become virtually impossible in our current landscape for Republicans to have a Senate majority with that composition. There's 104 senators, you don't get a majority anymore. At that point, they'll expand the lower courts and they'll expand the Supreme Court. I think this is just payback from Merrick Garland. No matter what Trump does, I think this is what we're looking at. So it's almost like unilateral disarmament. If you make a compromise, you'll get burned on it 2 years later. I don't think there's any sort of if you play ball now, you take options off the table. I think our government's beyond that point, which is unfortunate.
But if people understand that before the election, that is as intense a motivator as I can imagine. Let's talk about who some of the candidates might be, if not Amy Coney Barrett.
The list is short, my friend. So Trump has 44 people on his list. About a dozen of them are women. So we can, sort of narrow it down right away. Judge Barrett is at the top of the list. There's another judge from Florida. Her name is Barbara Lagoa. Mm-hmm. She's a children of Cuban refugees. Her parents came to this country as refugees from Castro's regime. She was appointed to the Florida Supreme Court by Governor DeSantis. And then Trump put her on the Federal Court of Appeals about a year ago. I think she has a wonderful life story. Someone who's seen the byproducts of totalitarianism, I think, is a good person to have on a federal bench. She knows what government power looks like and where it leads. I just have the slightest reservations because she's only been a judge for a short time. She was in the Florida Supreme Court for less than a year. She's been on the federal bench for less than a year. I just don't know enough about her to be able to make an informed judgment. There's another judge apparently in the short list. She's my age. She's 36 years old. Michael, I'm slacking.
Yeah, right. You thought you were doing something,
dude. I am underachieving compared to this judge. Her name is Allison Jones Rushing. She's a federal judge in North Carolina. She's been on the bench about a year and change. She was put on the federal bench when she was 34, 35 years old. Again, I think if Trump puts her, it'll just be thermonuclear. She could serve for 60 years.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to mean it, but that's just, how many people are listening to your audience are 35 years old or have a kid who's 35? So, is your kid ready to be in the Supreme Court? Just ask that question. I think very highly of her. I just don't think this is her time. She needs to, do some more of judging to get there.
What's fascinating is Ruth Bader Ginsburg was the fourth oldest justice to ever serve at 87, as you know. So three justices served past her. John Paul Stevens served till 90, and when he retired from the court, then, of course, she became the oldest. What a legacy if you did nominate and get confirmed a 36-year-old justice. She could realistically serve, I mean, easily 50 years if she makes it to 86, 87, which Ruth Bader Ginsburg is. And Ginsburg served 27 years. You're serving almost twice as long as Ginsburg did, and Ginsburg was there forever. I mean, it's just amazing.
Yeah.
Appointment begins to have real meaning when somebody's 36 years old.
You know, she just started appointing people out of law school, you know, the South Texas class of 2020, who wants him to Supreme Court. But, you know, Michael, it may not be as illustrious as you think, right? The court's been at 9 members now for more than 150 years. If the court winds up having 11, 13, 25, 52 members, you know, the 36-year-old doesn't look so, you know, cool anymore. It won't be as selective. But yeah, the 35, Judge Barrett, I think, is 48 or so. So, I mean, she's you know, she's not a spring chicken, but she, you know, she's been around the block for a bit. But yeah, the 35-year-old in the Supreme Court. I just know Justice Joseph Story was appointed by President Madison when he was 32. He was a very influential justice. So there is some precedent here, my God. In the 1800s, we're in a different world.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, there tend to be certain issues that are at play in a nomination that really rally both sides for or against a nominee. Obviously, abortion is a huge issue with Amy Coney Barrett being, you know, considered sort of the front runner here. Pro-life, lots of children, her relationship to Catholicism, you know, these sorts of things. What are some of the other hot button issues you think that are going to motivate both sides? I guess you always have guns, right? But what are some of the others?
Yeah. I think an issue that's sort of lurking in the background is free speech. We're living in a society now where certain viewpoints are just considered forbidden. I'm sure, you know, there are people listening to you on the radio right now who want to take you off the air.
Yeah.
I think Judge Barrett will be good on free speech also. I think she understands the risks of censorship and what happens when you have labels like harassment and these sort of vague allegations that are justifying, you know, people getting canceled. I think that's an area that she would understand quite well, given what she's been through. I think she gets that element of our society, of our culture.
Is that what you foresee as the biggest hot button issue to face an incoming justice in the next session?
I think the issue of free speech has been agreed upon by all 9 justices. It's one of these rare issues where these cases are 9-0. I think that unanimity is starting to fracture. I think some of the left justices are starting to see that, you know, hate speech and harassment and these other sort of buzzwords are should not be protected under the umbrella of free speech. I think these will be more divisive. And I do think we'll start seeing governments have greater ways to prosecute and to punish people for improper thoughts and improper speech. I know I'm sounding perhaps Orwellian, but I do think what we're seeing among college campuses and some of these protests is that certain speech just does not warrant protection because you disagree with it. And just certain ideas are considered too dangerous. I'm not talking about threatening people or trying to, you know.
Allied Outdoor Solutions has been a show sponsor of ours in our Houston flagship market for almost 20 years now. And it's been fun because they've gone from just a handful of folks to growing and growing and growing, doing beautiful backyard solutions to make your backyard, your front yard, your side yard, your front driveway look like a resort. And over the years, they've added Austin, San Antonio, Dallas. And what the work they do, you can see it for yourself at AlliedOutdoorSolutions.com or have them come do it for you. 844-846-1010. 844-846-1010. I have a buddy named Ray Briers, and he owns a company called The Pipe Yard Inc., INC.com. And if you have a project that needs carbon steel pipe, he stocks everything you need. New surplus, secondary, you name it. Rat hole, mouse hole, conductor casing, pipe pile, sign pole, structural, road bores, dredging. If you're buying or selling, you got an abandoned pipeline, wherever, he'll buy it. ThePipeYardInc.com. 409-788-PIPE. 409-788-PIPE.
Cause an assault on someone. This is just ideas.
Sure. Was it Voltaire who said, "I may not like what you have to say, but I'll defend till the death your right to say it"?
That's gone.
We continue our conversation with Professor Josh Blackman, including what happens if the president does not nominate or cannot get confirmed a Supreme Court justice, and we have a 4-4 split and a presidential election that is thrown to the Supreme Court. Lots to talk about coming up.
The Michael Berry Show.
A quick reminder, you can get your Michael Berry Show merchandise, gear, you name it, at michaelberryshow.com. Click on it. T-shirts, mugs, pins, bumper stickers, all sorts of fun stuff. 10% goes to Camp Hope, our residential treatment center for veterans with PTSD. The other 90% of profits will be donated or given or earned by Chad Nakanishi and Ramon Robles. It's our way of creating kind of a virtual tip jar for those two. So thanks for everything you buy on there. It goes to a great cause.
I need love.
Passing of Ruth Bader Ginsburg on Friday, we have the ultimate expert, the man who knows everything on the subject, Professor Josh Blackman of the South Texas College of Law. Professor, Senator Ted Cruz took to Fox News and then CNN and ABC and a number of outlets over the weekend to make the point that we must have 9 members of the Supreme Court with an election 40-odd days away. We need to be able to have a 5-4 majority because this election might be, as 2000 was, sent to the Supreme Court for determination, and a 4-4 split just won't get it. Your thoughts on what if that happens?
Lord help us. We can pray with Judge Barrett, maybe. I think, Michael, there's an easy answer to your question and a hard answer to your question. I'll give the easy answer first. If the Supreme Court divides 4-4 and it ties, what happens is a lower court ruling would stand. So let's say the Federal Court of Appeals rules for Trump, that's what stands. Or if a state Supreme Court rules for Biden, that's what would stand. So the upshot is the court goes 4-4, there's a ruling and the lower court ruling stands. But there's no obligation that Trump or Biden will abide by that, and which is why it gets dangerous. I think what Cruz is getting at is not the crisis is if the court goes 4-4. The crisis is if Trump or Biden says, screw this, I'm not letting some silly state Supreme Court decide the election, right? You know, these are elected judges. You know, think of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. You have, you know, a majority of Democratic appointed justices, right? They're partisan. They're not life tenured judges. I'm not, Texas too, we have a all Republican Supreme Court. Right. If you have a political Supreme Court where people are appointed by the governor's political party and they serve for election, are these the people you want deciding a presidential election? And I could see Trump, and frankly, I could see Biden saying, you know what, screw this. We're not letting the, pick your court, Wisconsin Supreme Court, which is now all Republican, decide the election. At that point, it's very ugly. It gets very grim because once a presidential candidate says we're not following this ruling, there's no arbiter. In 2000, Al Gore, for whatever his worth, said, I'm going to follow this judgment no matter what. And he did not march in the streets. He did not, call out the militia. He just relented. I don't know if Trump or Biden, let's just make it even. Let's say the Pennsylvania Supreme Court rules for Biden or the Wisconsin Supreme Court rules for Trump. And then there's no Supreme Court of the United States resolving it. I don't know what happens. We're sort of in this gray area of law where it's not clear. Someone's getting sworn in on the January 20th. I just don't know who that person is. Mm. I think there'll be riots. I think there'll be violence. I mean, look at the violence and riots we saw in the streets for the last 4 months. We have a pandemic going on. We forget about that, but, we still have to wash our hands every half hour. But it's scary. I don't know how to resolve. I think we're at such a tipping point that we don't have a neat resolution of that issue. So I pray that whoever wins by a large margin, where it's not needed to go through these process, But look, we have these absentee ballots. We have the mail delays. We have everything going on in the world. It's going to be ugly the next few months, Michael. I'm not optimistic. I'm sorry.
What does Ruth Bader Ginsburg's absence from the court take from the court? Good or bad, indifferent. But what was her presence and how did she affect the overall court?
You know, Justice Ginsburg's biggest influence was not through majority opinions. She was mostly in dissent for her career. She had a couple of significant cases involving gender rights and women's equality, but I can count those on one hand. Most of her work came in dissent, and she wasn't even the primary dissenter for most of her career. Justice Stevens, who you mentioned, was the senior liberal. He would take all the good dissents for himself. So Justice Ginsburg doesn't have that many, you know, famous opinions. I can count them on two hands. They're not many, but they exist. So this doesn't sound callous, but immediately her impact will not have a huge, I'm sorry, her absence will not have a huge impact. But I think she served a different role. She was a pop icon, which is not easy. She became a global celebrity. This little woman from Brooklyn, 5 foot nothing, maybe weighed 90 pounds, became a global icon. And that's stunning. I mean, just to think about that, there are very few justices who can achieve celebrity. And perhaps a justice achieves celebrity is counterproductive if they lose their bearing. It happened to her some time ago. But she became an icon. And I think there are lots of young women throughout the world who looked up to her. You know, I like Elena Kagan, but she's not Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She can't do that.
No.
I like Sonia Sotomayor. That's not her. She's not going to achieve that super celebrity. She just doesn't have that sort of aura around her. I don't know if that should be replaced. Just like Scalia can't be replaced. I don't think Ginsburg can be replaced on that with that impact outside the court.
Antonin Scalia called her the leading and very successful litigator on behalf of women's rights, the Thurgood Marshall of that cause, so to speak. And they were close friends going back to their shared time on the D.C. Court of Appeals. Was part of her influence that she was certainly more moderate than Kagan and Sotomayor and perhaps more likable on a personal level?
Likable, maybe moderate, not. She was probably the most liberal member on the court. I don't want to downplay that. She was quite liberal. I don't think she was moderate, but she got along well with people, which is important. She was able to agree to disagree. She was able to build relationships with those she disagrees with on matters of common interest. Scalia and Ginsburg loved opera. They watched opera together. You know, you don't need to yell at someone, throw bombs at them every 2 seconds. You can let work sit and go enjoy a meal and you know, have a happy New Year party. And they were very good at that. I don't know that the other justices are quite as good as Ginsburg was. Kagan might be. I don't know about Sotomayor. Breyer sort of just gets along. But I think the personal bond is key.
That's interesting. And, you know, if you read The Brethren, which is the last really intense, in my opinion, review. I mean, Mark Levin wrote a tome, a 1,000-page tome on that. But The Brethren really captured what a fraternity that is of these people who are kind of walled off like monks away from society, you know, serving their penance. At least that's the way it used to be. We'll continue our conversation with Professor Josh Blackman of the South Texas College of Law coming up.
Captain Something Wong.
Well, something must be right.
You're listening to Michael Berry.
Quick reminder, if you'll go to michaelberryshow.com, that's our official website, and while you're there, buy your official Michael Berry Show gear and wear it proudly. We appreciate you. That's all at michaelberryshow.com.
Our fourth and final segment with Professor Josh Blackman. Thank you for making time for us. Let's talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her legacy. We were talking about her friendship with Antonin Scalia. That surprised a lot of people. They were friends on the Court of Claims, and then they brought that friendship. And upon his passing, You know, she made clear what a good man he was and what a dear friend. And his son, Chris Scalia, has noted, you know, that his father's friendship to Ruth Bader Ginsburg was very important. And I think neither of them compromised their values, and it didn't affect their opinions, but they did so with much more civility than maybe political candidates can do, and yet sticking to their guns, right?
That's right. Scalia would always tell this story where he had circulated a dissent where he criticized Ginsburg, and she read and was like, wow, that's good. And she actually modified her majority opinion response to the Scalia dissent. And Ginsburg said, the Scalia dissent made my majority stronger. And they played off each other well. It's always good to have a friend who you disagree with who can tell you you screwed up.
Yeah, respect.
Even if you don't change your mind, you can make your position stronger.
So Jimmy Carter appoints her to the Court of Claims. Then June 14th, 1993, Bill Clinton appoints her to replace Wizzer White. And interestingly, I read that I think it was Orrin Hatch from Ohio, Republican, who suggested to Janet Reno that this would be a good nominee. She claimed that at the time she was considered a moderate. Many people say at the time she was sort of presented as a moderate. Clinton, I think at that point, was trying to govern from the middle or be perceived as doing so. Why do you think she was put on the Supreme Court? What about her stood out to the new Clinton administration?
Well, to be frank, Clinton's first choice was Mario Cuomo.
Yeah,
it wasn't Ginsburg.
Right.
Cuomo did not want the job. But Mario Cuomo is Governor Andrew Cuomo's father, so
do you think he didn't want the job, or do you think he feared the nomination process would not be pleasant for his closet?
I think he liked being governor, and being a Supreme Court justice doesn't mean you can't schmooze, you can't, you know, politic, you can't do things Cuomo's like to do. It's not a job for everyone. You know, would Barack Obama want to be a Supreme Court justice? Would Michelle Obama? I mean, they're both lawyers, but it's not a very, most of the job is pretty boring. I mean, 90% of the cases are terrible. They're not very interesting. But I think Clinton picked her because he became entranced by her. He met her and he just fell in love with her character, her story. And I think he thought she'd be a very strong role model for the court and for the nation. There's only one woman at the court. He wants to pick another. So Ginsburg was his strong pick. They did have concerns about her health because she was in her 60s at that point. Then she lived another almost 30 years. The age isn't always clear. When you appoint them, how long they serve for.
Well, and let's talk about that. 1999, she is diagnosed with colon cancer. She's been on the court for 6 years at that point. It would be the first of her five bouts with cancer. Pretty amazing. 2009, 10 years later, she has pancreatic cancer, which is a deadly and fast-moving cancer. Here we are 11 years later. 2014, she has a stent put in. So she's had a series of health problems throughout, and there were prominent court watchers and advocates and Democrats, liberals, who were saying during the Obama administration, why don't we have Ruth Bader Ginsburg step down? Her health is a serious question, and give us the opportunity to make that replacement. And she was very clear, I'm not stepping down. If the thought was her dying wish was that she be replaced by a Democrat, which by all accounts it is, there was your opportunity. They squandered that, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, look, this is what I mean by celebrity gets to your head. For years, Ginsburg said she would retire when she was 80. She would always say, when I was 80, when I was 80, when I was 80. That was her limit. And then when she turned 80, she's like, well, I'll retire when I can no longer do the job full steam. So she's lying to herself, right? She thought she was immortal. She thought she was invincible. She could have retired during the first 2 years of the Obama presidency when the Dems had 60 senators and they could have picked anyone they wanted, someone 20 years younger. Ginsburg would say, well, you think Obama could pick someone better than you? Yes, someone who's 20 years younger.
Right.
Right. I don't want to make this too callous, but yes, a justice who's younger would have been better in the long term. And a lot of Democrats called her selfish, and frankly, she was. Now her dying words were, my most fervent wish is to be replaced by the next president. Now, just think about those words for a minute, Michael. The next president. If Trump wins re-election, Ginsburg can't keep my seat open for 5 years. So 2021, That's what she said. 2026. My math is right. Right? No. 2025. I can't do math.
Yeah.
I don't know what day of the week it is anymore. 2025. It's a very partisan statement, and it's unfortunate that her last words to the public, her et tu, Brute, right? Her final parting words are, F you, Trump. You're not getting my
seat. She's done that before, right? And that's the reason I'm troubled by this canonization of her, is that she's one of the people, you called her a pop icon, which to some extent she was. They made her one. She made herself into a partisan. And the court has always stepped away from that and steered clear of that. And yet she embraced that and furthered that. And I think it's a terrible trend, and it doesn't end well. And I think we should note that. We can do all the encomium we want on what a great person she was. But truthfully, she was bad for the court in that way.
Look, I got dragged on Twitter for this earlier, and I was basically criticizing her partisan statement. And I get it. No one likes speaking ill of the dead, and it's tough. I'll limit my criticism to this one point. Her comments put the court in a tough position, because whoever fills the Ginsburg seat will now basically have a hex upon them. As if Ruth Ginsburg from the grave to put a hex on Amy Coney Barrett, that she didn't comply with Ruth Bader Ginsburg's wishes. I wish Ginsburg hadn't said that. She put her colleagues and her successor in a very tough spot. She didn't need to. Michael, we've seen a lot of people, their obituaries, they write their obituaries in advance, and their obituaries, don't vote for Trump. And people, their dying words are, don't vote for Trump. And I can't get that a person's life has to be so bound up in this political awful moment that that's usually their parting words, not, I want world peace, or I want equality, or, whatever the NBA is putting in the back of their jerseys. I stopped watching, by the way. Mm. This is a message. Trump, you can't have my seat. Come and take it.
But it really, to me, bespeaks a smallness when you limit yourself to the moment. It's like tying yourself to a brand, a fad, a trend. I can't imagine Winston Churchill, his dying breath being, make sure you leave the Johnny Carson show on or whatever. There should be something greater. You're serving on the Supreme Court, and, I haven't spent the years in law that you have, but I went to law school and got an LLM because I love the law and the history and the richness of all that. And I just feel like, in many ways, she has reduced that. Very interesting times. Professor Josh Blackman, it's always a treat when you come and join us and share your wisdom and experience. And I know we'll be seeing you all over the television and the radio in the coming days as this thing heats up. And, of course, we'd always love to have you back. Professor Josh Blackman of the South Texas College of Law, a.k.a. Mr. Smarty Pants.
I have a buddy named Ray Briers, and he owns a company called The Pipe Yard Inc., INC.com. And if you have a project that needs carbon steel pipe, he stocks everything you need. New surplus, secondary, you name it. Rat hole, mouse hole, conductor casing, pipe pile, sign pole, structural, road bores, dredging. If you're buying or selling, you got an abandoned pipeline, wherever, he'll buy it. ThePipeYardInc.com, 409-788-PIPE, 409-788-PIPE.